An Osho Talk. The Discipline of Transcendence. Talks on the 42 Sutras of Buddha. Volume 3, Number 4.
The first question. We have learned from you that freedom lies in the transcendence of the mind, and it is the knowledge and the understanding of the mind which brings about its transcendence. The major part of religion deals with the mind, and so does psychology. As modern psychology has successfully discovered and revealed the structure and process of the mind, would you call it a religion, or a branch of religion, or a parallel religion? How do psychology and religion differ from each other? Kindly point out whether psychology and religion can be helpful to each other. Religion understands mind in a totally different way than psychology. Their approach is different. Their goal is different. Their methodology is different. Psychology studies the mind as an object from the outside. Of course, it misses much. In fact, the most essential is missed. Only the periphery can be understood that way. The innermost is not objective. The innermost is subjective. You can study it from the within, not from the without. Psychology is as if somebody wants to study love and watches two lovers hugging each other, holding hands, sitting together, making love, goes on collecting data, how two lovers behave. This won't give him any idea what love is. Because love is not on the surface. The surface can be very deceiving. The appearance can be very deceiving. Love is something very inner. Only by being in love you know it. There is no other way to know it. Psychology tries to understand mind from the outside. The very approach makes mind material. Only matter can be understood from the outside, because matter has no insight to it. The mind can be only understood from the inside, because mind has no outside to it. The first thing. That's why psychology goes on becoming more and more behavioristic, more and more materialistic, more and more mechanical, and more suspicious about the soul of man. The soul is completely denied by psychology. Not that the soul does not exist, but because the very approach prohibits it. The very approach becomes a limitation. The conclusion depends on the approach. If you start wrongly, you end wrongly. The second thing to be understood, that psychology tries to understand mind, not to go beyond it, because psychology thinks there is no beyond to it. It is the end. Religion also tries to understand mind, but not to understand mind itself, but to go beyond it. The understanding is to be used as a stepping stone. So religion is not concerned with the details of the mind. An essential understanding of the functioning of the mind will do. If you go into details, there is no end to it. Religion also studies dream, but just to make you awake. That's all. Dream itself is not the concern. It does not go deep into the dreaming structure. And it does not go ad infinitum analyzing dreams. It simply tries the essential structure of the dream to transcend it, so you can become a witness. It is totally different. For example, if I give you a seed of a beautiful tree, and you become too much concerned with the seed, and you try to understand it, and you dissect it, and you go on and on, trying to understand and dissect more, the chemical structure, the physical structure, the atomic structure, the electrons and neutrons, and you go on and on. And you completely forget that the seed was meant only to become a tree. And howsoever deep your dissection, by dissecting a seed you are never going to come to the tree. You will come to the atomic structure of the seed. You will come to the chemical structure of the seed. You may come to the electric structure of the seed, but that has nothing to do with the tree. And the more you dissect the seed, the more you are farther away from the tree. Your dissection is not going to bloom. Your dissection is not going to spread its fragrance. And one day, if you have dissected it too much, and then you put it in the soil, it won't sprout. It is already dead. In dissection you killed it. You murdered it. Psychology is interested in mind just as if you are too much obsessed with the seed. Religion is also interested in the seed, but not for itself. Interested in the seed because it carries in it a potentiality, a possibility of becoming a beautiful tree, a possibility of blossoms, a possibility of fragrance, a possibility of song and dance, a possibility that many birds can come and make their nests on it, and many travelers can rest under its shade. But the concern is not the seed. The concern is the tree. I hope you can see the difference. Religion's concern about the mind is only as a stepping stone. The mind has to be understood because we are entangled in it. Let us take another example. You are thrown in a jail, in a prison cell. The religious person tries to understand the structure of the jail, only to find out ways how to escape from it. Is there a gutter that can be used to escape? Is there a stupid guard who can be befooled? Is there a window which can be broken? Is there a wall you can climb over? Is there a right moment when guards change and the gap exists? Is there a right time in the night when guards fall asleep? Or Are there other prisoners who are also interested in getting out of the prison so you can be together and help each other? Because climbing alone may be difficult. Getting out of it alone may be difficult. A group can be created and the group can become a power. You understand, you try to understand the structure of the jail just to get out of it. But if you get too much interested in it and you forget completely the goal and you go on studying jail, the walls and the warden and the prisoners and the guards, and you go on making maps about the structure, then it is stupid. Modern psychology is a little stupid. In the East, we had also developed a tremendously significant psychology. I call it the psychology of the Buddhas. But their whole interest was in how to get out of the prison of the mind. Use its structure to go beyond it. Modern psychology is absolutely obsessed with the structure of the mind and has completely forgotten the goal. These two differences, they are very vital. Religion understands from within. Of course, then it is a totally different thing. When you study mind from the outside, you study somebody else's mind. It is never yours. And if you go to the labs of psychologists, you will be surprised. They go on studying the minds of rats to understand human mind. It is humiliating. It is very disrespectful. The understanding that is based on the rat's mind cannot be of much help. When a meditator watches his own mind, he watches human mind alive, throbbing, beating. And he watches his own mind because that is the closest you can get to the mind. From the outside, you can never get very close to the mind. From the outside, you can infer, but it will remain inference. It can never become knowledge. Because even rats can deceive you. And they have been found to deceive. Even rats are not just on the surface. Their innermost core remains inaccessible. Why psychologists go on studying rats? Why not men directly? Because men seems to be so complex. They study elementary structures. It is as if you want to study Einstein and you go to a primary school and you study a small child. And from that understanding, you develop the understanding of Einstein. It is simply absurd. It is not right at all. The direction is wrong. Every child is not going to become an Einstein. If psychologists were right, then every child will develop into an Einstein. But every child is not going to become an Einstein. Only a certain child has flowered like Einstein. If you want to understand Einstein, the only way is to understand Einstein. But how to understand an Einstein? From the outside, he is as ordinary as anybody else. His distinction is inner. His uniqueness is inner. If you study his blood, his blood is as anybody else. If you study his bones, they are just like anybody else. In fact, Einstein's brain has been studied after his death. Nothing special. That is something to be noticed. Nothing special has been found. But certainly he was a unique man. You cannot deny it. Maybe there has never existed such a subtle mind on earth before. Nobody had ever such glimpses as he had. But the brain seems to be as ordinary as anybody else. Brain is not the mind. It is as if one day I am gone and you go into my room and you study the room. And you try to find out what type of, what manner this man was who lived in this room. Mind is the guest. The brain is the host. When the mind is gone, the brain is left. Brain is just the room you used to live in. If you study from the outside, you can dissect. But you will find only the brain, not the mind. And to study the brain is not to study the mind. Mind is elusive. You cannot hold it in your hands. You cannot force it into a test tube. The only way to know it is to know from within, from your witnessing self. The more you become aware, the more you can watch your mind, its subtle functioning. The functioning is tremendously complex and beautiful. Mind is the most complex phenomenon on the earth. The most subtle flowering of consciousness. If you want really to understand what the mind is, then you will have to detach yourself from your mind. And you will have to learn how to be just a witness. That's what meditation is all about. Psychology can become helpful to religion. But then psychology will have to change tremendously. A radical change will be needed. And psychology will have to become more meditative, introspective. And psychology will have to listen more to the East, to the great meditators, Patanjali, Buddha, Mahavir. It will have to listen to their understanding. One thing more I would like you to notice, to keep in mind. Psychology has developed through the study of the pathological mind. That too is something unbelievable, ridiculous. Psychology has developed by the study of the neurotic, psychotic, schizophrenic, the ill mind. Because who goes to the psychoanalyst? Never a healthy person goes to a psychoanalyst. For what you will go to a psychoanalyst if you are healthy? You go only when something goes wrong. You go only when some illness takes possession of your mind. When you are not normal, then you go to the psychoanalyst. Then he studies the pathological mind. Studying the pathological mind, he comes to certain conclusions. Those conclusions are applicable only to the ill mind. They are not applicable to the normal mind, and certainly not for a mind who has gone beyond mind. They don't say anything about a Buddha. They cannot say. No Freud, no Jung, no Adler has ever studied a Buddha. In fact, the fault is with the psychoanalysts, because Buddhas have always existed. When Carl Gustav Jung came to the East, there was a Buddha alive, Ramana Maharshi, but he won't go to see him. He was even suggested, many friends suggested him, that you go, but he won't go. Maybe a subtle fear that his knowledge will prove futile there. a certain ego that he is a great psychoanalyst. Why he should go to anybody? But certainly Buddhas are not going to come to your laboratories. You will have to go to them. You will have to be respectfully close to them to understand them. They are not going to lie down on your couch. You will have to develop different methods. You will have to develop different structures to understand them. And if you don't go, they are not at a loss. Psychology suffers. Psychology has remained on the level of the pathological. It is not even at the level of the normal man. For example, if you ask a psychoanalyst, what do you say about Mahavir? Because he threw his clothes and became naked. Certainly they will say he is a certain type of psychotic. Many mad people suffer from that disease. Or he is an exhibitionist. He wants to show his naked body to people. A sexual pervert. Is this right about Mahavir? And whatsoever they are saying after a long study. But they have studied mad people. And they are true. The wrong comes only they are stretching their understanding too far away. Mahavir used to pull his hairs. He won't go to a barber. Because he said even to depend for that on a barber is a dependence. So he will simply, when the hairs will be too big, he will simply pull them and throw them. Now ask the psychoanalyst what he says. He will say this is a sort of madness. There are mad people who pull their hairs. You may have also observed when your wife goes mad, she starts pulling her hairs. Becomes angry and wants to pull her hairs. A certain craziness. And they are right, and yet not right. Their understanding remains at the pathological level. Ask them about Jesus. Many books have been written about Jesus. Because Jesus seems to be closer to them than Mahavir. They have neglected Mahavir, and it is good for Jainas that they have neglected Mahavir. Otherwise they will prove certainly that he is a neurotic. About Jesus they have written many books that he is mad. That he is a megalomaniac. Why they say this? Because there are cases in madhouses. Somebody says, I am the only prophet of God. Have you heard the famous anecdote? In Baghdad it happened. A man declares in the days of Khalifa Umar that I am the real prophet. After Muhammad I have been sent to the world. Of course Mohammedans cannot tolerate such a thing. At least not Mohammedans. If he was in India he would have been tolerated. But Umar could not tolerate, he was thrown in the jail. But after 7-8 days, another man declared that he is God himself. Now this was going too much. That man was thrown into jail. After a few days, Umar went to jail to see, because both were beaten badly, punished badly. He thought now they may have come to their senses. He went and he asked the man who was declared himself the new prophet. And he was laughing. His whole body was with wounds. Blood was flowing out of the wounds. But he was laughing loudly. Umar says, "Why you are laughing?" He said, "When God told me that you are going to be my last prophet and the final prophet, He has told me also that they will treat you badly. They always treat prophets very badly. And now the prediction has come true. So I am laughing. It simply proves that I am the prophet." While this dialogue was going on, the other man who was tied to another pillar started laughing even more loudly. Umar asked, "What is the matter with you?" He said, "This man is a liar. I never sent him. In fact, after Muhammad, I have not appointed any prophet to the world. Muhammad is my last prophet." You can find in madhouses many people, and the psychoanalyst's understanding depends on them. And when Jesus declares that I am God's only son, the only begotten son, of course he is mad. Certainly. Because there are mad people who declare such things. He is also mad. When Krishna declares that I am the creator and the destroyer of the world, certainly he is mad. This is the ultimate in being an egoist. What more you can? How you can be more egoist than this, that I am the creator and the destroyer of the world? And Buddha says, "I have attained to the ultimate, and even gods come to my feet to have instructions from me." Now these are mad people. Psychoanalysis still remains at the level of the pathological. It has not known even normal human mind, and it has not touched even the supernormal. But sooner or later, a great revolution is going to happen. Because if psychology does not change itself, then it will be in a rut. Then it will go stale and die. It has to move. Everything alive has to move ahead. And this much I can say about psychology, it is very much alive. And there is hope. Much work is going on. And by, psychoanalysts, psychologists, psychiatrists are becoming more and more interested in meditation. You will be surprised. I have got all sorts of people here. From different professions people have come. But the most sannyasins have come from the profession of psychology, psychoanalysis. I have got hundreds of psychotherapists as my sannyasins. This is very significant. Not so many doctors have come. Not so many engineers have come. Not so many bankers have come. Not so many politicians have come. The greatest number from any single profession is that of psychotherapists. That's a great indication. That shows psychology is moving beyond itself. Psychology is moving into religion by and by. Sooner or later, psychology will become a very firm foundation for religious leap. And unless it becomes a firm foundation for religious jump, it will not have any meaning. It will get its meaning only when it becomes a step to the temple of God. But when I say when it becomes a step towards religion, I mean simply religion. I don't mean Hinduism, Christianity, Judaism, Mohammedan, Jaina, Buddhist, I don't mean. Those are not really religions. They have become politics. They are political organizations. A religion is very much individual. Religion is basically individual. It is a transformation of the individual consciousness. It has nothing to do with organizations. You are a Mohammedan, are a Hindu, are a Christian, because you are born in that organization. Nobody can be born into a religion. Religion has to be consciously chosen. In the very conscious choice, it becomes significant, otherwise it is meaningless. You have been brought up as a Christian. You don't have any personal relationship to Christ. You don't know Christ. You know only the Pope and the Church. And the Pope and the Church and the priests and the Shankaracharyas. They are not religious people. They have very subtle politics hidden behind them. Racial, national, sectarian. And once a religion becomes an organization, and people start being born in it, without any personal contact, without any personal search, without any personal encounter of the Master, when people simply are born in it, when religion becomes accidental, it is no more religion, then it becomes a sort of opium for the people, an exploitation. So I don't mean Jew, Hindu, Christian. I mean simply religion. Religion has no adjective to it. Let me tell you one anecdote. Listen it very carefully. Sigmund Steinberg, the well-known importer from ladies' gloves, paid an unexpected call on the rabbi of his temple. That worthy was more than pleased to see his fabulously wealthy congregationer, who more than made up in contributions what he lacked in attendance and religious zeal. This time, however, the trip to the temple was for a completely religious, if rather unusual, reason. Rabbi Steinberg commenced after the usual amenities, "I am here to see you about someone most near and dear to me, mine own, mine darling, mine three times a champion, Westminster Abbey the Third, mine little Pudela. Is this coming? This above 13 years old, and I want Rabbi, you should bar mitzvah him." The rabbi was completely taken aback. "But my dear Steinberg, that is impossible. Who has ever heard of a dog being bar mitzvahs? There is never in the history of the Jewish religion any mention of such a thing. It would be a scandal. The temple would be a laughing stock. My orders would be revoked. The sisterhood would be abandoned. The building campaign would be halted. The Gentiles would be hysterical. And the board of directors would have my neck." Steinberg was unmoved. Without so much as the bait of an eyelash, he addressed the rabbi again, "For the occasion, I am donating to the temple the amount in cash of $5,000. "Mr. Steinberg," the rabbi beamed, "why didn't you tell me in the first place the dog is Jewish?" When it comes to money, then even a dog becomes Jewish. when it comes to money and politics, then your popes and your Shankaracharyas are no more religious. Their religion consists only of rituals, dead rituals. It is a facet. It is not the reality. A real religious person has always found it difficult to exist in any organization. Jesus was born a Jew but could not remain in the Jewish fold. It was impossible. The priests won't allow him. He fell out of it. Not only that, they killed him. Buddha was born a Hindu, but Hindus won't allow him. The priests won't allow him. Because whenever there is a religious person, he is such an alive revolution. He is a rebellion incarnate. The priests won't allow him. He was thrown out of the Hindu fold. Buddhism was destroyed from India. Jews killed Christ. Hindus killed Buddhism, which is more subtle and more cunning. By killing Christ, nothing is killed. Hindus are more clever. They never killed Buddha. Had they killed Buddha, it would have been very difficult to destroy Buddhism in India. You can see Christianity is there. And Christianity has flowered out of the crucifixion. Without cross, there would not have been any Christianity. By crucifying Jesus, they made Jesus so important, so historical. Hindus are more clever and cunning. Very clever. They say Buddha is our 10th avatara. But they make it in such a clever way. They have a story in their Puranas. That when God created hell and heaven, millions of years passed. And then devil went to God and said, "Sir, why you have created hell? Because nobody comes there. It remains empty. Not a single soul has turned. People are so religious that everybody dies and goes to heaven. So what is the point of keeping it? And relieve me, I'm just getting fed up and bored." God said, "Wait, I will do something." And he took an avatara. He descended on the earth and became Buddha. To destroy people's religion, to destroy people's honesty, to destroy people's truth, to confuse them, he became Buddha. And since then, hell is overflowing. Now this is very tricky. On one hand, they accept Buddha is an avatar, incarnation of God. On another hand, they say, beware of him. Because he has come only because the devil had appealed. So if you listen to him, you will go to hell. Of course, he is a god. You see the cunningness? Even Jews have been defeated by Hindus. They raised Buddha to the 10th avatara. And they destroyed Buddhism completely. This has always happened. This will always happen. Try to understand it. Just by being born in a household, in a certain religion, is accidental. You have to choose. You have to move on your own. It is an arduous journey. It is a great challenge and adventure, and there is great risk. The second question, if I am God, how come I wake up every morning to find myself in this body? for a god, everything is possible. Ah, dear, last night I dreamed of thousands of orange elephants, all wearing malas of their white elephant king. What can this mean? This simply shows that not only man, but elephants can also go mad. The fourth question. After each of your discourses on Hasidism, I would leave glowing and feeling life is a leela, to be lived fully and enjoyed. Yet when you talk about the Buddha, I feel despairing and everything seems futile. Does the Buddha ever laugh? He laughs but never before his disciples. He laughs when he is alone. Listening to me on Hasidism is half of the leela. And unless you can go with laughter while listening on Buddha, your laughter is not very deep. Listening to me on Hasidism, of course, you were laughing and enjoying and you were thinking that life is leela. Immediately I have chosen Buddha. There is a mathematics to it. It is a dialectics. I never choose haphazardly. Things were going too sweet with Hasidism. You need a little bitter medicine also. It was daylight with Hasidism, now it is night. With Buddha it is night. But unless you can enjoy night also, your enjoyment of the day is not complete. Unless you can be happy, even seeing the futility of life, you have not learned what leela means. If you are happy only when you are happy, you have not learned anything. When you are happy, even when there is no happiness, then you have learned the secret of it. Do you follow me? It is a very simple mathematics. When I am singing a song of life, you enjoy it. But when I start singing a sad song about death, then you cannot enjoy it. Then you will remain partial. Then you will choose the good, the sweet, the light part. What will happen to the bitter part? What will happen to the dark part? Then you will never be a whole, and if you are not whole, you can never be holy. With me, sometimes it is life singing and sometimes it is death. And I would like you to learn both. I would like you to become so happy, so playful, that even when there is despair, there is no despair. Even when things are going rough, you can laugh. Even when things are going very heavy, you can dance. So try to laugh with Buddha also. To laugh with Hasidus is very easy. To laugh with Buddha is difficult. It is an uphill task. But to laugh with Hasis, anybody can do that. It requires no effort on your part. It requires no growth on your part. To laugh with Buddha, great growth, maturity is needed. And life consists of these polarities, good and bad, success and failure, day and night, summer and winter, birth and death, marriage and divorce, love and hate. The whole life consists of these diametrically opposite polarities. And you are the whole. You cannot choose half of it. If you choose half of it, you will remain half. And the other half will remain repressed. And the other half will take revenge someday or other. And if you cannot be really sad, happily sad, I say, then your happiness cannot go very deep because you will become afraid of death. In death, the other is waiting. So your happiness will be shallow. You will not allow it to go very deep because the other is waiting there. You know that if you go a little more deeper, you may touch sadness. Have you watched it? In villages in India, mothers say that a child should not be allowed to laugh too much because if he laughs too much, then he starts crying. It is a great insight. Have you watched it? If you laugh too much, your laughter tends to turn into tears. All happiness tends to turn into unhappiness. All life tends to turn into death. Youth tends to turn into old age. Health tends to turn into illness, disease. This is how things are. And if you learn only that I will be happy while I am happy, what you will do with your unhappiness, that is also there. If you say that I will be happy only with the rose flowers, what you will do with the thorns, which are almost always there, and more than the flowers? They are part of the game. With Hasidism I talked about the roses. Now let me talk about the thorns. And if you can understand both and still be playful, then you know what Leela is. Leela means playfulness. Playfulness in success, playfulness in failure. Playfulness when you are winning, playfulness when you are being defeated. The fifth question, am I okay? You cannot be. Certainly not. Otherwise the question will not arise. The very question says something is wrong somewhere. Otherwise, who will bother to ask it? Okayness is such a feeling that when it is there, you know it. It is just like a headache. You never ask, have I got a headache, to anybody else. And if you ask, they will laugh. They will say, have you gone mad? If you have, you have, and you know. If you don't have, you don't have, and you know. Okayness is inner well-being. A great, beautiful feeling arises in your being and goes on spreading, ripples upon ripples. Everything seems to be light. Everything seems to be weightless. You don't walk, you run. You don't run, you dance. You feel as if gravitation does not exist. You start flying. You move in unknown bliss. You go on drifting very peacefully into the soar of the unknown, towards the soar of the unknown. And everything seems to be beautiful, a blessing. You are blessed and you can bless others. When it is there, There is no question. When it is there, you need not have any certificate from anybody. You know it. It is self-evident. And if okayness is also not self-evident, then nothing can be self-evident. Mullah Nasruddin and his wife were on a rowboat. The wife was shivering in the rowboat while Mullah Nasruddin was fishing. "Tell me again," she cried between blue lips, "how much fun we are having. I keep forgetting." Nobody can go on forgetting if there is bliss. A man purchased a second-hand car, and then after 7 days he went back to the place he has purchased and he asked the salesman, "Please tell me again about this car." He said, "Why?" He said, "I go on forgetting. You praised it so high." And it gives me so many troubles. Just to encourage me, tell me again. I need a little encouragement. Why do you ask, am I okay? Do you need some encouragement? Remember, I am not an old car salesman. And I am not going to encourage you. If you are unhappy, then my suggestion is be unhappy. There is no need to be okay. Be unhappy. Go into it, to the very rock bottom of it. Let it be there. Listen to its message. There must be a certain message in this unhappiness, because God never sends anything without any message in it. Don't try to hide it. Unhappy, then be unhappy. Be truly unhappy. Go to the very hell of it. And if you can go without any rejection on your part, without any fight on your part, if you can simply relax and let it happen, you will gain tremendously out of it. You will see that unhappiness is there, but you are not unhappy. You are the witness of it. You are the observer. It is there, certainly it is there. But it is like a cloud that surrounds you, but you are not the cloud. And once you realize that, you have transcended. Then a totally different kind of okayness arises in you, which is spiritual, which cannot be taken away from you. But people don't go deep in their unhappiness. This is what I call real sadhana, to go into your unhappiness. Don't avoid, don't escape. People don't look in their moods. People try to deceive themselves. People want somehow to carry on smiling always and always. But do you know, even in heaven, angels don't sing all the time. There are moments when they cry and weep. And you can believe me, I am an eyewitness. But nothing is wrong in tears. Tears can be beautiful if you welcome them. Go deep in your unhappiness, it is going to reveal many things to you. I have heard a farmer was driving his horse laboriously along a dusty road. He came to a man sitting beside the road and pulled his team to a halt and called out, "How much longer does this hill last? You aren't on no hill. The stranger called back, "Your hind wheels is off." But people don't look deep down in their being. They think they are on a hill. The hind wheels are no more there. You can go on in a plane, on a plain road, on a super highway, and you will feel that you are on a hill, always going up, and difficult, and more difficult. And of course, without wheels, you will always be in turmoil. Rough will be the road. Don't ask me, are you okay or not? The very question decides that you are not. But people are such questioners. They go on asking everything. Maybe you are okay, but you cannot remain without a question. That too is a possibility. Mullah Nasruddin went to the hills on the suggestion of his psychotherapist. And from there, he wired back after a week, "I am feeling happy. Why?" Now, even you cannot feel happy without asking. Now, analysis is needed. Why? The mother went to see the analyst and asked, "Tell me, I got a daughter in college. She does not use drugs. She is not pregnant. She does not drink. She got the highest marks in her class. And she writes to us every day. Tell me, where did we go right? Where did we go right?" Now that becomes the problem. Questioning has become such a deep-rooted habit that sometimes when it is not needed at all, then too you go on making questions. You cannot allow your being to remain without questions. Allow it. Because that is the moment when the answer will come to you, when there is no question. Don't go on questioning and questioning and questioning. It is meaningless. I answer you only so that you learn how not to question. I don't answer you so that you can become more knowledgeable. I answer you only as a help so that one day you can remain without questions. That very day, a great revelation will open its doors to your being. When there is no question, the answer arises from your innermost depths. If you are too much concerned with the question, the answer will never arise. You won't allow it a space to arise. The sixth question, is dirt really dirty? It depends. It depends on your outlook. Nothing is good, nothing is bad. It depends on your interpretation, how you interpret. It depends on your mind. Mind always divides things into the good, the bad, the clean, the dirty, God, devil. The mind continuously divides. Mind is a divider. The truth is undivided. The truth is one. It is neither good nor bad, nor clean nor dirty. I have heard, a priest went into a tailor's shop and ordered a new suit. When he asked how much it cost, the tailor said, "There is no charge. I never charge the clergy." So the next day the priest sent the tailor a beautiful crucifix. Then a rabbi went into the tailor's shop and ordered a new suit. When he asked how much it cost, the tailor said, "There is no charge. I never charge rabbis." So the next day, the rabbi sent the tailor two more rabbis. It depends on you. How you look at things, your mind is finally the decision maker. A successful cloak and suitor had finally found the girl of his dreams, and he made preparations for a wedding. The garment district would never forget. His own designers prepared a wedding gown for the bride of the finest imported silks and satins, and his own marital raiment was truly a sight to behold. The affair was nothing less than breathtaking. No expense has been spared. Then as the newlyweds were about to embark on their honeymoon trip to Canada, an urgent message arrived in the form of a telegram. "It is from my partner," the groom explained. "Urgent business. I will have to attend to it immediately." "But what about our honeymoon?" the bride asked tearfully. "Business comes first," he said. "But you go ahead. I will catch a letter plane and be there by tonight." "But what if you can't make it by tonight?" she moaned. "Then," he blustered, "start without me." A businessman is a businessman. His whole outlook about life is that of a businessman. Nothing is good, nothing is bad. Nothing is beautiful, nothing is ugly. It is you who decide. In India, we have a certain stage of consciousness called Paramhansa. The state of Paramhansa means the state of no division. When ugly and beautiful, clean and dirty, good and bad, both are alike. You can find a Paramhansa eating, sitting by the side of the road. The gutter is overflowing. The dogs are running around him. Or even the dog also eating from the same bowl. Very difficult. Very difficult for the mind to understand. The mind will say, "What type of man is this? How dirty." But you don't know the state of a Paramhansa. Don't condemn. Don't be in such a haste. There is a state of consciousness where divisions disappear. When the mind is totally dropped, then one simply lives in oneness with existence. But I am not telling you to become Paramhansas, remember. You cannot become a Paramhansa. It descends on you. If you try to become a Paramhansa, you will simply go mad. I'm not saying that drop distinctions. I'm saying become more and more aware, so one day distinctions disappear. You can drop distinctions without becoming aware, then you will be a madman, not a Paramhansa. And sometimes Paramhansas and madmen look very alike. The seventh question: today's discourse is the most wonderful thing I have ever heard. It is from Vandana. But about the same discourse, somebody else has said, why you go on chattering continuously? I am fed up with you. I am bored. And I don't want to listen to you anymore. It is from Manisi. Now what to do? Whom to answer? The same discourse can be tremendously beautiful to one. To another it can be terribly boring. It depends on you. It has nothing to do with the discourse. You are not saying anything about the discourse, Vandana or Manisi. You are saying something about you. Vandana must have been in a flowing state. Vandana must have been in a beatitude. Vandana must have been open. I could enter into her. My words went deep into her heart and became songs. Manisi must have been closed. Too much in the head. Manisi must have been without heart, at least in that discourse. Then everything went wrong. It depends on you. Whenever you feel something like that, always remember it depends on you. Now, Manisi asks, why you go on chattering? I go on chattering because there are Vandanas also. So I have to go on chattering for them. And you say, I am fed up with you and I am bored, but who forces you to be here? This is something beautiful. There are two guards on two gates. And Shiva, with his big nose, is there to smell you. And you have to pay to listen to me. Have you ever heard in the history of India, it has never happened. Religious discourses are always free. And you ask me why you go on chattering. Why you pay in the first place? You need not come. All management that I can make to prevent you, I have made. It is your mind. But I know Manisi. I know his heart also. The heart goes on pulling him here. The head does not allow. That is the conflict. When heart and head meet, there is a synchronicity. When head and heart meet, there is a harmony. That's what happened to Vandana. Manisi has lost contact with his heart. His heart goes on pulling him here. So he cannot escape. Because he cannot escape, he is annoyed with me, as if I am doing something to him, that I don't allow him to escape. You are completely free, Manisi. Though I know you cannot escape. It is impossible. Because wherever you are, you will hanker for this chattering. I will haunt you. Because as far as your heart is concerned, I am in possession of it. The head will not allow you totally to be here. But it cannot help you to go away either. Listen from the heart. Because what I am saying has nothing to do with the head. What I am saying is not logical. What I am saying is not rational. Just the other day, I was reading a letter in Current, written from some rationalist association from South India, that they would like me to become a member of their association. Now I am overwhelmed. This is such a great honor. Even if a Nobel Prize was given to me, I would not have so much overwhelmed. Because Nobel Prizes have been given to so many people, hundreds. Who has ever heard about this rationalist association, that it has invited anybody else to become a member? This is without precedent. In fact, I have never heard the name of the village also. Must be a very esoteric association. There are esoteric groups who work completely hidden behind, who don't believe in publicity. Such a great privilege. I hope the village has a post office and a primary school and at least a bus stop. Because in India, every village that has a bus stop and a primary school and a post office starts claiming for a university. It is enough to open an university. That's why every day universities are being opened. Hundreds of universities. Sooner or later, every village is going to have its own university. Just one condition they have met, that is very simple, and I can fulfill it immediately at the drop of a hat. One condition they have made, that if you drop being called Bhagavan, that I am ready, absolutely ready. Because in the first place, I am a Bhagavan. So whether you call me or not makes no difference. A rose is a rose is a rose. You can call it by another name, that makes no difference. I can pretend that I am not a Bhagavan. There is not a much problem in it. But I cannot lose this membership. The trouble arises not by their condition. The trouble arises, it is a rationalist association. And I am absolutely irrationalist. I am almost absurd. I play with reason, certainly, as a toy. I enjoy reason, certainly, but as a toy. But I am not a rationalist. Those who hear me from their heads will go on missing me. And when you hear me and you miss me, of course you will be fed up. You won't be able to see what is the point of it all. Why this man goes on saying, because you don't get anything out of it. I go on nursing you. And you are there without being nourished. Then certainly you will feel bored. But boredom is your problem. And you have to learn how to listen from the heart. If you listen me from the heart, you can go on listening me eternally. And there will be no boredom at all. The more you will listen to me, the more you will enjoy. Because from the heart, a tremendous revolution happens. Have you observed small children? You tell them one story, next day they come, they say, again tell the same story. And you say, but I have told you. They say, okay, but you tell me again. And they are so thrilled. Again listening the same story. And they know. And sometimes they will tell you ahead what is going to happen. But they are so thrilled, so enthusiastic about it. What is happening? They hear it from the heart. They hear from innocence, not from knowledge. they hear from a tremendous purity, from love. They hear for the hearing's sake. Howard, who was one of New York's leading custom tailors, went to Rome for a vacation. While there, his wife, who was a firm believer in when in Rome, do as the Romans, insisted that they have an audience with the Pope. It was arranged through the American embassy, and they were granted their audience. When they returned to New York, they told one and all of their trip, and of course, about the visit to the Pope. Howard's father asked Howard, "Tell me, what is Pope really like?" His son replied, "He is 42 Sarge." A tailor is a tailor. That is his understanding, 42 Sarge. Jack came home in the middle of the afternoon. He was met at the door by his wife and his son. His son exclaimed, "Dad, there is a bogeyman in the closet." Jack rushed to the closet and flung the door open. There, huddled among the coats, was his partner Sam. Sam seized Jack. "Why in hell do you come here in the afternoon and scare my kid?" Get it? It depends on your mind, on you, what attitude you will take. You can listen to me ear in, ear out, and you can remain thrilled. But I'm not worried about that. At least I am always thrilled. If nobody comes to listen to me, I will go on talking here. I love to say that which has happened to me. And I love to say it 1,001 times. And that is the only way to convey it. Because one time you may miss, second time you may miss, how many times you can miss? One day, out of sheer boredom, you will say, "Let us now listen to this man." The last question. I hate to do this to you, but I can't resist the temptation. What about the robe? This is from Manisa. The first thing, Morris came home from work early one day and found his wife in bed. She said she was not feeling well. He went to the closet to hang up his hat and coat, and to his surprise, he found a man hiding in the closet. He looked at him and shouted, "What are you doing in my closet?" The man shrugged and said, "Everybody has to be somewhere." So what about my robe? I have to be in my robe. Everybody has to be somewhere. But the question was going to come, whether from Manisa or from somebody else. I was waiting for it. The towel was like a buffer state. Let me tell you about a buffer state first. In diplomacy, in politics, the clever nations always has buffer states around them. For example, the Britishers in India used to have Tibet as a buffer state between China and India. China is the greatest power close to India. A buffer state they always maintained. Tibet was the buffer state. If China ever wants to attack on India, first the China will have to attack Tibet. It cannot approach directly. And once it attacks Tibet, British will fight on Tibetan grounds. So India remains untouched. When India became free, China attacked Tibet. And Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru missed. He was not a diplomat, he was a poet. He was a visionary. A great soul. But not a politician at all. He thought it doesn't matter to us. Why we should be worried about it? It is between China and Tibet. Britishers won't have allowed that. It was not between China and Tibet. Basically it was between India and China. Tibet is nothing. Once China took possession of Tibet, of course the next step was bound to be India. If instead of Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, Indira was there, she would not have allowed it. She is more down to earth. Less visionary, less of a poet. She would have fought there in Tibet. But Jawaharlal thought, there is no point. It is them to decide. Once Tibet was possessed, of course, India became vulnerable. And next step was India. And China attacked India. It was just natural. It was simple diplomacy. My towel was my buffer state. I knew it well. Once I drop it, you will ask about the rope. So it is better I should take my towel back.
Vivek, bring a towel.
Because it is better to keep it. It is safe. It is my Tibet. The joke has already been stretched too much. 3 days have passed. And the joke should not be stretched too much. Otherwise it becomes dangerous. Manisha, are you satisfied? Enough for today.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.